I came to your face. I didn't like it one day, she said. She didn't have to show me her long fingernails, though I glanced at them surreptitiously or so I hoped. Then, lost at the threshold, unwilling to enter for fear of what I might find, I segued as quickly as I could. When do you go back to school? I quit, she said. I'm not going back. I tried to look into her eyes, to recapture the intimacy we once shared, but the drapes were pulled too close. For 2 years, a droplet of time from where I now sit, we were inseparable. I'm not sure what she saw in me, though our email exchange 40 years later confirms my suspicion that we were two rudderless souls in search of calm passage, or maybe just camaraderie through those early adolescent years. She pulled me away from my hopeless attempts to join the popular crowd and showed me the appeal of rebellion, though I never quite met her standard. What did I offer her? Stability, she implies in her retrospective analysis, and friendship, which may have been in short supply in the mid-50s for a conspicuous outsider. And that she was, by design, I always believed. She wore mostly black and carried her school books in a green cloth bag slung over her shoulder, while the rest of us cradled them in the crook of our arms. She read poetry from slim paperback volumes and took private French lessons. Her second-generation Italian family was devoutly Catholic, which led to further mystique. She knew more about sex than anyone else I knew. I felt honored to be her friend as I moved from 7th grade to 8th. My previous best friend had been welcomed by the popular crowd without inviting me along. A part of Kate's mystery lay in the then recent tragic loss of her father, who had died of a sudden heart attack when she was 10, leaving her mother to raise Katie and her two older sisters. They lived in a large, somewhat unkempt house in one of the better sections of town. Her mother, by the time I knew her, had acquired a bookstore or newsstand in a prime downtown location that catered to the segment of the university student population that smoked Marlboros, read Allen Ginsberg and Jack Kerouac, and slid behind the counter magazines into the folds of the Village Voice, which arrived from New York City a day late. The newsstand left Mama with little time for maintaining the house, which became the almost exclusive domain of the three daughters and the large dog that left clumps of hair on every surface. It was the house in which I first ate pizza, first shaved my legs, first sipped wine, first smoked a cigarette, and learned from Katie's sister that men preferred women with rounded rather than pointy breasts. They were wise beyond belief. It is summer, 1959. Christina, the older sister, 19, is driving. Beth, the middle sister, is sitting in front with her. Katie and I are in the back. The windows are open, and a warm July wind blows the long, dark locks of the three sisters and my own shorter brown hair. I am the sturdy Germanic exception to their live Mediterranean beauty. We are on our way to Ocean City, New Jersey for a 3-day holiday, just us girls on our own, staying in a guest house a block from the beach. The older two are in charge, which has somehow reassured my parents. But Katie and I are not children. At 14, we can look after ourselves. And that's what Christina and Beth want us to do, leaving them free to prowl the beach in their bikinis. Katie has a not-quite-bikini two-piece. My own swimsuit is a full-cover one-piece, which makes me feel lumpish, though there is not a chance I would reveal my midsection. We wrap ourselves in towels and walk barefoot from the rooming house to the beach. We have just finished eating hamburgers for breakfast at a diner down the street and have decided to eat hamburgers for every meal while we're here. I find this an act of rebellion, since my parents would never approve. Katie appears to take it for granted that we would eat what we please, when we please. I pretend to be as nonchalant as she is, about the hamburgers, about the sisters on the make, about the uncomfortable absence of adolescence. We are almost at the beach when we notice a priest walking toward us. Katie assumes a demure attitude as he nears, stops in front of him and says, "Good morning, Father," crossing herself as she speaks. "Good morning, child," he replies, pausing to place a hand on her head. I guess he can tell I'm not Catholic because he doesn't bless me in this way. Tomorrow's Friday, I said. I was out of earshot. Will you eat hamburgers? Oh, sure, she said. I'll go to confession, will you? I don't remember when our friendship began to wane, but by our first year in high school, I had abandoned her in favor of a less conspicuously rebellious peer group, though we continued to share the wider circle of eggheads. By our senior year, Katie had perfected an aura of remote disinterest in her peers. She was in the school play, wrote for the school literary magazine, attended parties, and yet I think of her alone in the hallways or in the back corner of the classroom, disengaged, dark, brilliant, and worldly. She managed what the rest of us only dreamed of, to cultivate a social circle of university students. Among the regular customers of her mother's newsstand, where she worked with her sisters and hung out after school, she found a niche as the mysterious and precocious daughter, the youngest of the trio of dark-haired beauties. I sometimes stopped into the newsstand when she was working and found her, cigarette in hand, deep in conversation with a bearded student or engaged with a group discussing the latest issue of the university literary magazine. I quietly bought a pack of gum or a copy of Newsweek and slipped away. Did she do drugs? Did she have sex? There were rumors. I didn't really believe them. My parents did. When one of my father's graduate students, a man in his mid-20s named Mike, left his wife and young son, for whom I babysat on occasion, Dad began asking me questions about Katie. How well did I still know her? Not so well anymore. What did I know about her relationships? Not much. The word among his colleagues in the university's theater department, he said, was that she and Mike had been carrying on an affair which led to the marital breakup. That can't be true, I said. Dad gave me a strange look and shook his head, perhaps surprised at his daughter's naivete. Was it true? I have no idea. This was in the months just before graduating from high school. Katie and I had drifted far apart, and my mind was on going away to college. I didn't really think about where her mind was. The next time I saw her, she moved her face.
She what?
She'd ripped her face to shreds. This is another unpublished piece, short, pretty freshly written. It's a small personal reflection on the world that we find ourselves navigating. I think the only thing you need to know, if you don't already, is that I live in a rural community along a sluggish river. In northern Ontario. Is that better? Okay. This is called Inside the Circle, My Small Life. It's weirdly warm for November. Usually, if we don't have a bit of snow on the ground, at least it's raw and miserable. Instead, it is sunny and 14 degrees, and I am miserable. The planet is sick, and I refuse to see this as a beautiful day. I plan to stay inside and nurse my grudge against the state of the world. A little past noon, I look at my Fitbit, which announces that I've logged an embarrassing 790 steps. I sigh, take myself in hand, lace up my shoes, and set out, wearing a long sleeve tee and an unnecessary vest. There's a pervasive world weariness these days. The world is a wearying place. If it's not the horrors of Gaza or the endless carnage in Ukraine, it's the social and political turmoil south of the border, where an aspiring dictator is making rapid strides to turn the global order into a single-player video game with his hand on the joystick. Joy itself is in short supply. And then there's the latest UN climate report, which I can hardly bear to read. Closer to home, in this rich country, too many people are having trouble making ends meet, lining up at food banks, living on the streets. Did I mention the possibility of a bird flu epidemic? The opioid crisis? North Korean missiles? AI taking information systems, that's the wider world. It's real. And it frightens me more than I can remember being frightened in a very long time. I choose a route I haven't taken much recently. First, on the road along the river as usual, but then when the road turns away from the river through a neighbor's field, so I can continue on the water's edge. I began walking because I know I should. But in spite of my initial lethargy, I find myself starting to emerge from the gloom and walking in a pleasant sort of stupor. I have a friend who often contrasts the wide world with her small life. It's in that small life that I'm surprised to find myself now on this familiar path with the sun at my back and the river on my left. A protective fog has surrounded this present tangible reality as I walk to the turnaround point, where a fence separates me from a herd of grazing cows. The fact that cows do not usually graze in November drifts through the fog, but doesn't linger. The river is still barely moving, the sky an astounding blue. A few birds fly overhead, an occasional tansy plant displays its still brilliant yellow flowers among the brown weeds, and wild asparagus splays golden ferns. The same friend goes on to say, even in the darkest times, people get up and make breakfast. Her way of pointing out that our small lives go on in the midst of global upheaval, which, of course, they do. I remind her, though, that only those who don't die or have food in the house can actually make breakfast, and she nods to my persistent gloominess. True enough. I take a break partway home. Just before I leave the field and return to the road, there's a large maple tree close to the riverbank. Exposed roots arch forward over the shallow bank and into the muddy water's edge. I push through some tall grasses and ease myself into a sitting position on the ground, leaning against the trunk, and look up. The world is as small as this little circle that contains me. A tree, brown grasses, a patch of river, the blue sky. It is mid-February now, though it feels like mid-March. Winter temperatures have continued the trend set in November, and again, I'm having trouble acknowledging a beautiful day when I see one. Winter should still have us in its grip, but however cold the nights, daytime temperatures have been creeping above freezing most days, as they have many days all winter. Excuse me. I've only worn my extra heavy coat a few times. There's snow on the ground, though. And there's snow on the ground, though, and the usual grumblers are grumbling that belong winter, though it is only February. I got up this morning and made breakfast. Then I turned to the news of the day. As usual, it was distressing. As usual, it filled me with feelings of helplessness and hopelessness. The situation south of the border is escalating. In a recurring theme, the aspiring dictator once again has his sights set on Canada. I think of Austria in 1938. Is this what comes of living next to a madman? He says he will break our economy. I'm afraid he could. Rage is rising from within me and has nowhere to go. Remembering that day in November, I lace up my boots and walk out in search of my small life. This time, when the road turns away from the river, I follow it. Despite the warm days, the field path is still deep in slushy snow. Today, I cannot push the road aside. It presses hard against me. I fear for my children and grandchildren. I fear for my country. I fear for the planet. This morning I made breakfast. It was all I could do. It was not enough. From inside the small circle of everyday life, I see the planet tipping, and I don't know how I can help to right it. I search the horizon for flickers of hope and am sometimes rewarded, but not often enough to overcome a profound unease that refuses to stay on its side of the circle. The world beyond is a darkening place. My small life continues, as do all of our small lives. We make breakfast. We celebrate birthdays. We remember to take our meds. We laugh and cry at the things we've always laughed and cried about. We get haircuts, as though in the grand scheme of things, haircuts matter. I will plant my vegetable garden again this year, that annual ritual of faith and hope. I will feed that hope by staking the tomatoes and thinning the carrots. My grandchildren will visit, and I will celebrate their growing sense of themselves and their places in this vortex. Spring is as weirdly early as fall was late. The sun burns hot through a t-shirt and a light sweater. The snow is gone, and I venture along the muddy path through the field. When I reach the maple tree by the river, I stop in search of that November moment. The river is moving slowly, carrying slabs of ice, which is breaking up on the lake and drifting downstream. A few migrating buffleheads sail by, and a large bird, probably an osprey, is perched on a high tree, too far away for me to identify because I'm not really a birder, rarely carry binoculars. Bird song bounces against the walls of this moment. I can't name the birds, but I know they are singing for me. And within the circle of my small life, they try to speak of spring.
There is a wider shop on the other side.
Thank you. Okay, this is a piece that I've read in Guanajuato before, but I think it was back in the days when we had the open mics once a month. That was quite a long time ago. And I doubt it's memorable enough that anybody's going to say, oh, that again. It's somewhat edited from a chapter in this book that's called, the chapter is called It's Sunday, It's Mexico. All right. 20-some years ago, I sat in a university lecture hall listening to a presentation that changed the way I look at myself and other people. I don't remember the name of the presenter, somebody or other, PhD, whose talk was part academic lecture and part roadshow. He was good. I don't know if his evidence was, though a quick internet search all these years later suggests the theory he presented is still in vogue. It's one of those, there are two types of people in the world theories, of which we should all be suspect. Here's how it goes. At rest, people experience various levels of cerebral stimulation, which I must say at the outset is not correlated with intelligence, unfortunately. Those whose levels are naturally low feel a biological pressure to increase them. And so they seek out external sources of stimulation like social interactions, adventure, learning opportunities. These people, extroverts, are energized by such interactions. Not so introverts, so the theory goes, whose brain activity at rest is naturally high. Their biological imperative is to ramp down. Introverts may appear to be outgoing, chatty, socially engaged. They may indeed enjoy the company of others, but social interactions are tiring for them, sometimes awkward, and they must regularly seek solitude in order to recharge. Yes, we are. There's one in this. It's obviously because most of us, of course, are somewhere along the continuum. Still, I walked out of that lecture with my personal evaluation checklist and a new understanding of myself and my spouse. Some of you knew my spouse. It's obviously because my brain at rest is just more active than yours. I wasn't bragging, just reporting. Which is why you're so happy doing nothing, he replied. He too had just taken the quiz and come out very high on the extrovert scale. I'm not doing nothing. I'm enjoying what's going on in my head. And I'm not really an extrovert, he insisted, turning up the car radio. Everybody knows he was. He was the one who would turn, "Hi, how are you?" into a 15-minute diversion in the cereal aisles, while shoppers maneuvered their carts around him and glared, reaching past him for the raisin bran. He was the one who would carry on a conversation in the car while listening to Leonard Cohen. He was the one who suggested we invite virtual strangers to dinner. Well, what I considered serene, he considered boring. What he considered stimulating, I considered chaotic. And what I considered a normal, comfortable approach to retirement, he called sitting around and waiting to die. Well, actually, I had more than that in mind. Extroverts, who, according to some estimates, make up approximately two-thirds of humankind, leap into new endeavors with a fervor that leaves the less outgoing of us choking in the dust with their enthusiasm. They learn new languages and adapt to new situations quickly. They're energized by crowds and fireworks and wedding receptions, which is why they can't understand those of us who feel the need to retreat to the bathroom an hour after the party starts. I think we have weak bladders. February 1998. The city is Guanajuato. Tonight, it's music. Last night, it was a soccer game. The television from the soccer stand outside the bedroom window doesn't usually start blaring until the wandering minstrels have finished their tuneful parade through the narrow streets and performed a musical stand-up routine on the plaza just below us. We couldn't believe it our first night here when this quiet corner in which we rented a house for the winter turned into a nighttime fast food and concert center. True to form, I bury my head under the pillow to blunt the noise. I have more trouble blunting the irritation. People live here. They try to sleep here. How can this go on until 3 a.m. every night? We move to a different bedroom for the rest of the winter, without a window. Also, true to form, over the next couple of months, my husband gets to know the taco stand folks. We return 3 years later, again 3 years after that. Then, on the cusp of retirement, we buy a house in Guanajuato. We will not just sit around and wait to die. We will become snowbirds. February 2020. We are having dinner with our Mexican family, Antonio and Eloisa, the taco folks. It's not possible to pass through the door into this home without being fed. And I don't mean tea and a cookie. No matter the time of day, there will suddenly appear quesadillas and soup, bowls of fruit and yogurt, or a full meal of rice with chicken mole and salad. Just like her mother, says Antonio, she has to feed you. I've given up protesting. I just eat. I can't imagine the Mexican part of my life without these two, their children and now grandchildren. They helped us navigate parts of the culture that seemed strange to us. They included us in birthdays, holidays, even religious celebrations which they know we don't share. They entertained our grandchildren and brought us soup when we were sick. They were at our side that difficult winter when Jack was ill and diagnosed with cancer. Would this have happened if I'd stayed under the pillow, nurturing my irritation? Would I have learned to make tortillas in a Mexican kitchen? Would I have been mi abuela canadiense to four little girls and a little boy? When we return, well-fed to our Guanajuato home, a party is raging in the house across the small callejón, almost near enough to reach out and touch. The music is loud. The men drinking beer on the sidewalk are loud. Occasionally, a car pulls up playing its own loud music. The neighborhood dogs join the chorus. I reach for my pillow. The next thing I hear is the roosters. Setting off firecrackers this morning, asks my 9-year-old grandson. It's Sunday, I said. It's Mexico. The first time we visited Mexico, January 1994, we spent the winter in Pátzcuaro. We arrived on the very day in January the Zapatistas began their rebellion and woke the next morning to gunfire. We huddled, terrified, in our hotel room. Eventually, we emerged to find other hotel guests having breakfast and lounging by the pool, apparently unperturbed. But are we under attack? I asked. They looked at me strangely and laughed. Oh, that. It's Sunday. It's Mexico. You get used to it. We were nowhere near the Zapatista Rebellion. Soon after that first winter in Mexico, I realized I needed to learn Spanish. It shouldn't be that hard. A lifetime ago, I studied Latin for 4 years, French for 5 or 6. I haven't really used them, but I've lived in a bilingual country for most of my life, cereal boxes and all that. I registered for a university course, then a second one, Eastern. I could spot a subjunctive a mile away. Nuances of multiple past tenses, no problem. Oh, how I love grammar, a natural linguist. Then another winter in Mexico. More courses, mostly conversation. Suddenly my tongue and my brain were engaged in a standoff. Here comes the third person, Frederick is gone. While I grasp for it, conversations are gone without you. I watched my extrovert husband. He studied Spanish when he was younger, so it stood to reason he was more comfortable, but it was more than that. To everyone, all the time. Sometimes he made glaring mistakes. You said SBN should have been ESCA. He laughs, right, you didn't say anything. Well, yeah. But then, even in English, I don't strike up chats with taxi drivers and street vendors. If someone asks how I am, I say, fine, thanks. I can do that in several languages. It seems sufficient. It never occurs to me that the questioner wants to know about my recent recovery from the flu or the fact that I have opera tickets in my pocket. When someone I've just met asks where I'm from, I say Canada. Sometimes I add Ontario, near Lake Superior. I rarely launch into description of snow depth or what minus 40 feels like. I don't talk to virtual strangers about how happy I am to be here. Maybe I should. My Spanish would be better. I probably seem crazy. 15 years and many classes later, I've given up. I no longer study. I speak haltingly, nervously, and forget vocabulary as fast as I learn it. I decided a few years ago to go with osmosis, which in fact allows me to absorb and comprehend quite a lot. But when I open my mouth, I usually wish I hadn't. The extrovert, by the way, was fluent. It's Dia de los Flores, a pre-Easter celebration in Guanajuato. The streets are filled with couples who have been up all night dancing. They carry armloads of flowers amid the vendors that fill the narrow downtown plaza. The usually serene spot has been transformed into a warren of stalls and tables selling toys, hats, dolls, and plastic flowers of all shapes, colors, and sizes. People are packed shoulder to shoulder, moving at a toe-stubbing pace through the plaza. My own shoulders twitch from my inability to achieve even a modicum of personal space. Someone's recently purchased puppet stabs me in the left breast as I veer away from the mother with a child in tow passing me on the right. There is no escaping the crush of bodies, and yet I must. I signal, I'm out of here, and wriggle rudely through the crowd till I reach the steps of the basilica, where there are actually a few open spots. I catch my breath and sit, almost trembling with relief. The extrovert waves from the swarm of bodies below, and I understand that he will remain in the crowd. Later, we will walk home together and agree to disagree. I will never again attend. He will go annually from now on and return with colorful photos that say Mexico to him. My song to Mexico is a quieter one. The occasional early morning walk before the heat of the day, when the streets are still and the only sounds are brooms making their endless journeys across the streets and sidewalks. The welcome I receive each winter from the butcher at my neighborhood carnicería, and the amusement in the eyes of the greengrocer at my local fruiteria when I carefully select just two jalapenos. The smile on a child's face when I respond to a proud good morning in English with good morning to you. The sudden realization that I have understood a conversation at the next table, so perhaps osmosis is working. The thousand greetings from passers-by, Buenos Aires, Buenas noches, adios. Growing familiarity with the city itself and its rhythms, feeling less like a tourist and more like one who belongs, albeit temporarily. Night is falling quickly, as it does here. Two 12-year-old girls are perched on the low wall outside our house, sharing secrets. Beyond them, their brothers or cousins have divided into teams, shouting as they try to prevent the soccer ball from succumbing to gravity and bouncing down the steep hill. They are visiting their abuela on the other side of the callejón. She has no outdoor space, so the dusty, undeveloped area adjacent to our house is the playground of choice, notwithstanding the shards of broken glass and discarded beer cans. They're making good use of it. The ball bangs against the metal porton, someone shrieks, a toddler too small for the game runs into the melee and is rescued by a bigger cousin who hands him, sobbing in protest, to the 12-year-olds. He wants to be a big boy. Someone kicks the ball too hard and it flies over the wall and into our yard. More shouts, then bang, bang on the door to our patio. I set my book aside and open the door, knowing what I will hear. Hello, Monsignora. I fetch the ball, toss it back with a smile. The 12-year-olds have joined the game and the abuela is now sitting on the wall with the toddler and two babies. I exchange a few words about the evening, about the joy of grandchildren. The game continues well after dark, shouts echoing off adobe walls, the ball banging into the porton, occasionally prompting the plea to find it on our side. Bursts of firecrackers send up small clouds of smoke over the city. An impatient cab driver honks his horn. One of the neighborhood dogs begins a chorus and the others join in. Somewhere nearby, a marching band is playing. It's Sunday. It's Mexico. There is a, what I'm going to read comes from a chapter in this book called Growing Up Quaker, which I did. And this is just a little section from the end of that chapter. I'm trying not to stumble, but the high heels are giving me some trouble. I'm not really used to them, and Mom didn't think I should bring them, but I knew we'd be dressing up for church. Maybe she was right. Instead of making me feel grown up, they're making me feel awkward. I hope Rob, walking beside me, hasn't noticed, because I've concluded that I'm in love with him. He's almost 20, but everyone says I'm mature for 15. It's a spring Sunday morning in inner city Philadelphia. I'm here on a weekend work camp sponsored by the American Friends Service Committee. Jane and I came together by train on Friday. Walking from the bus to the downtown church where we would be staying, we had to step around garbage, and we saw some men sprawled out in doorways. I think they were drunk. I've never seen people drunk, nobody that drunk. Everyone on the street was black, which I was trying not to notice, though I wondered how that could be possible, and from the way they looked at us, I'm sure they were noticing that we weren't. I thought about Joseph when I was nine. This refers to an earlier thing. I wondered if a really enlightened person would be blind to the difference. I'd had 6 years since then to become more enlightened, and still I had to stop myself from staring. That night, the group of leaders talked to us about the slum neighborhood where we'd be working the next day, and then led a discussion about how the inner light propels people to action. Quakerism, we were reminded, is not just about recognizing that of God in every man, it is also about reaching out to it and meeting strangers as friends and equals. we would all be reaching out with paintbrushes as we help people freshen up their neighborhoods. On Saturday morning, we were assigned jobs in groups of two, and I couldn't believe how lucky I was. I was assigned to work with Rob, the only one who was not still in high school. The two of us spent all day together painting the hallway of an apartment where a single mother lived with her three little children, and an old man lay all day on the mattress without sheets. He never got up, and his room smelled awful. The paints we were using were all donated by a hardware store, and we were painting the hallway an ugly shade of green. I don't think we're spreading much light with this paint, I said. I guess nobody wanted to buy it, said Rob. That's why it's free. The mother tried to help us. That was the rule, the whole idea. We only volunteered with people who would work with us so we could all get to know and understand each other. But the man never got off the mattress, and the woman had to look after the kids, so we did most of it ourselves. By the end of the day, the hallway was only a little less dreary than before, but cleaner. Rob is in college. He's already spent 2 years in the Peace Corps in South America. He wants to be a lawyer for poor people. He's a conscientious objector and a Quaker. We are both wearing peace pins. He likes Pete Seeger. Oh, my God. We have so much in common. I've never really thought about it before, but I'm thinking I'd like to be a lawyer for poor people, too. Mom was right. I shouldn't have brought these shoes. I have to think about every step. We're on our way to church with the family whose hallway we painted. That's part of the weekend package, part of getting to understand other people. I'm wearing a blue suit with a pleated skirt and, of course, my heels. We are the object of considerable interest as we parade in all our whiteness along the sidewalk toward the African Evangelical Church. Inside, we sit with the woman and her children. The pew is crowded, so I am almost touching the drop. I have never been to an African church before, and I keep grinning and then stopping myself because I'm trying to be more sophisticated. This shouting and singing and clapping, and the preacher calls out people by name. There are other white people from our group here with the families they've helped, and he welcomes us all and preaches about brotherly love. Then there's more singing and a lot of people calling out, Amen. On my way back for the group's final meal together before leaving the city, on trains and buses. I walk beside Rob, trying to get up the courage to ask for his address, wondering if he is also a little bit in love with me. I imagine going to the same university, walking through a tree-lined campus, studying law together. As we approach the church that is our home base for the weekend, he turns to me and my heart does a little flutter. First time in heels, I guess. You'll get the hang of it, he says. In the train on the way home, Jane tells me that she, too, has decided she is in love with Rob. She sat beside him at breakfast, and he gave her his address. I think I'm ready for a mature man, she says, in her perpetually dreamy voice. She is a year older than me and knows how to walk in heels.
Story that you read about the gloom of the world,
yes,
and your internal gloom. I'm wondering, in the writing of that,
yes,
the impulse of writing it also was a way to deal with the gloom. Or was that something separate? I don't know.
I suppose so. It was written in chunks. I mean, it's got, obviously, in the sense of exactly correct. I wasn't walking in my home or whatever the delivery restaurant is here. but I don't know if writing was part of dealing with it. I did work on it quite a lot over the last couple of weeks, I guess. I had been thrown together. I can't answer that. I'm not dealing with the gloom very well. So hopefully that does help. Anything else?
We need to find good news channels.
I'm addicted to the bad news. I mean, it's a serious, I think.
Well, it's the easiest to find.
It certainly is. Yeah.
I'm wondering if you're writing now and if your writing differs when you're here as opposed to when you're writing in Canada. What are the effects of these changes? Because you've been coming now for a couple of years.
I've been coming for longer than a couple of years on my own. I'm actually not writing very much, is the honest truth. I'm not writing very much now, but I write more when I'm here because this guy here and I meet once a week to share what we're working on. And so it's hard not to get anything. So it's a little bit of a pressure thing.
That's why we have AI.
That's another story, isn't it? Yeah, I never thought of that. I'm not able to answer the questions people are asking. I don't know how to answer that. I'm not writing a great deal. I do write more here. I feel like I've written an awful lot of stories about my life. And I'm not sure that there's a lot more in that well, but I don't have read anything else. So
you have to solve that before you can continue on.
Well, yes, in some way.
Have you read your countrywoman's new memoir?
No.
Margaret.
Oh, yes, I have. It's fantastic. Absolutely fantastic. Yeah.
What's your method? Are you pen and paper or computer?
I'm computer. I was, and I break all the rules about writing because professionally I was an editor, and that's just so ingrained in me that even though you're not supposed to, you're supposed to just write and you're not supposed to go back and fix anything until you're done and just let it all spill out, and I cannot move from one sentence to the next until I'm happy with the one I just wrote. And I try to not care, and I can't not care, and so I break all those rules.
But you don't have to rewrite.
Huh?
You never have to rewrite.
Oh, yeah, that's not true. No, that's not true at all. I do write on the computer. I think my brain goes directly to my typing fingers. It's just how it works for me.
Sure. See, were you here last week when Louisa spoke?
I was.
So in a way, you're kind of the flip side of Louisa, in that you're really analyzing and perfecting as you go along, and she's not doing that at all. She's working in a totally different way, in a different medium.
And the interesting thing is that after Louisa's presentation last week, I said to myself almost exactly that. You're just so uptight about your writing. You need to loosen up with something. So I went and got a sketchbook and a bunch of pencils. And I've decided I'm going to sketch. Yeah. So far, I've done an apple and a pepper and a bookshelf.
That's great.
Oh, and a cat, yes.
That sounds like you've got the beginnings of an essay right there.
Yes, I perhaps.
Bookshelf and the cat.
Yeah.
That's a great title.
Yeah, there you go.
I'll work with that. Well, thanks, everybody.
Bye.
I just want to remind everyone tomorrow will be the cartoon film series. Some of them are for mature audiences, probably some of them are for their classes.
Hey, is there a price?
Oh, it's donations here. If people want.
Do you have any change by any chance from the library?
What do you, how much change do you need?
Like 80. I mean, yeah, or 100 or
something. I think here, there's 100.
Okay. It'll be up on you. Oh, okay, so that's even more than you have on there.
It's a world of war.
But I am going to talk about it. Yeah. How are you?
Hi guys!
Hi! How are you?
I'm good, I'm good.
Good. I didn't see you hiding in the corner.
I know it. If I can grab that comfortable chair, I do it. Because otherwise my back is
Yeah, I did.
Oh, okay. I thought your company came. I love it. You know, these people have such interesting activities. You know, I cook for them, clean up in the kitchen, vacuum, do laundry. I am. God, damn. I made 2 enchiladas today. Yes. Well, and flowers.
You only kick my chair once. Well done. Yeah, I know you do.
We just got here.
No, but they said we're
selling for